Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 5th, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, is the world of economics and politics. And I've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, an interview recorded earlier today with Hillary Wainwright on Tony Blair's troubles, what's going on around post-war investigations and scandalous tales of cooked intelligence. And it's much more of a scandal there than it is here. And we'll ask her what's going on and put into some kind of context of British politics. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Hamid Dabashi, who is a sociologist of culture who teaches at Columbia University, an expert in particularly in the culture, politics, and history of Iran. And now that Iran is at the topping of the vying with North Korea, I guess, for the top of the charts in the axis of evil, we'll ask him for his analysis of what's going on, both with U.S. policy towards Iran, but also what's going on within the country itself. And I apologize for my rough-sounding voice. Got a bit of a cold, and with weather like this, why not, you know? Actually, I discovered when I recorded the interview with Hillary Wainwright, who's in Manchester, England, earlier this afternoon, it's sunny and beautiful over there, and we've got rain and clouds in the forecast here, so there's something very seriously strange going on with the weather. And sort of apocalyptic, it seems. Before I get to this, the substance of the show, first of all, I want to thank everyone who pledged during this segment and also in the other segments as well, but I'm especially, of course, touched by those of you who pledged during this segment a couple of weeks ago. And please do honor your pledge if you didn't do it with a credit card. And if you're listening to this show on the Internet, I do archive all these shows on my website at leftbusinessobserver.com. You can also pledge either on the WBAI website. There's a link there if we're doing so, or you can do it the old-fashioned way by mail, WBAI 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 10005. But thanks to all of you who did pledge on this marathon special a couple of weeks ago. And now, as we've been doing for the last few weeks, a few months here now, actually, some looks at the economic headlines before we get to the interview with Hillary Wainwright. The U.S. economic scene continues to be dominated by the same themes that it was when I was last on a couple of weeks ago. The long-deferred recovery in the broad economy, the weak job market, and the continuing risk of deflation. The two most prominent measures of consumer attitudes are heavily in the news. These are monthly surveys conducted by the University of Michigan Survey Research Center and the Conference Board, a business-sponsored research group. Attitudes are supposed to be a forward-looking indicator. Most economic stats are backward-looking. That is, they measure activity that happened weeks or months ago. But the confidence measures are supposed to predict rising spending if the confidence measures are rising, or falling consumer spending if the confidence measures are falling. Both the Michigan and Conference Board measures rose sharply in May. They were released several days ago. And this cheered the stock market immensely. But both indexes are comprised of two subcomponents, an evaluation of the present situation and of expectations for the future. The present situation measures reflect what's going on in the job market and with household finances. The expectations measures are driven by what people read in the papers or hear on TV. And the papers and TV have been full of talk of a post-war bounce and a second-half recovery in the economy. The May pop in both confidence indexes was driven entirely by sharp rises in expectations. Evaluations of the present situation declined in both indexes. Bounces in the expectations indexes are often premature. In both recessions of the early 1980s and early 1990s, they were about a year ahead of the eventual economic bottom. Workers' evaluations of the job market are looking pretty gloomy. One of the questions that the Conference Board asks in its confidence survey is how people find the job market. Are jobs easy to get, about middling, or hard to get? And the jobs hard to get component of the Conference Board survey hit a recent high in May. So about a third of the population says jobs are hard to get, a very, very high number for that series. And Gallup's latest readings of employee sentiment, taken in late May, are still weak as well. There was a pre-war decline in worker attitudes and a post-war bounce. And these measure, you know, people's outlooks for their job, the risk of job loss, how secure they feel in their employment. There was a bounce in that after the Iraq war is over, but now they're back in decaying, and they're back pretty much where they were last November. As Gallup's chief economist, Dennis Jacob, put it, there's just no sign that the jobs recession is ending. This morning, the weekly release of the first-time claims for unemployment insurance took an unexpectedly large leap to 442,000. That's how many people lost their jobs last week and visited the local Labor Department offices to make their initial applications for unemployment insurance. More people than that actually lost their jobs, but many people are not eligible for unemployment insurance. But 442,000 in 1 week is a large number, and usually considered pretty close to recession levels or above. And also, almost 4 million people continue to draw unemployment insurance. So these are pretty high numbers and stubbornly resisting any signs of recovery. Tomorrow morning brings the release of the May employment report, which, as I've frequently said in this spot, is probably the best single indicator we have of the state of the economy. It's very timely, it's very important, and it's very accurate. And it's certainly not perfect, but it's really, if you have to look at just one measure of what's going on with the U.S. economy, that's the one to look at. It'll tell us how many jobs were gained or lost last month, how many people were unemployed, how many people dropped out of the labor market, all kinds of important and revealing statistics. It's likely that somewhere over 50,000 jobs disappeared last month and the unemployment rate crept higher. This would not be happening if the economy were recovering. Meanwhile, Alan Greenspan has been playing the markets masterfully. He's just speaking a few words, and the markets are responding to his magic words, like loyal love slaves. He's been saying a couple of things. He said, we've got a recovery coming ahead, but not yet. The economy is still weak, and there's still this risk of deflation. And the way he puts this all together pleases just about everybody who's listening, because the stock market likes a story that recovery is coming eventually, sometime later in the year. The bond market likes to hear that deflation is still a risk, because that means, you know, conventionally, when the economy recovers, the inflation rate picks up, and bond investors don't like inflation because it eats away at the value of their portfolios. So whenever he says the recovery is ahead, but the deflation is still a risk, it makes both the stock and bonds markets happy. And of course, no one really studies these statements for inconsistency. Maybe, you know, it's just that people want to hear what they want to hear, and what they want to hear is the best of both worlds. But when they say here that there's still a risk of deflation, that the recovery is not here yet, that means that the Federal Reserve is likely to push down interest rates in the near future, even further than they are already. It means that they're certainly not about to raise interest rates anytime soon, and the economy likes that, the financial markets like that, and everybody is happy. Greenspan did say that the labor market is exceptionally weak, which is a very accurate characterization, For now, he's just being masterful at orchestrating the reactions from the various financial markets that he wants. And presumably, low interest rates and a rising stock market will help that recovery along. We shall see. It may not happen that way. If we have, if we're in a situation like Japan's, that is a deflationary stagnation, that's going to extend for a long period of time, then no amount of low interest rates will stimulate that. Japan has record low interest rates, some of the lowest interest rates in the history of the finance going back many, many centuries. So, but it hasn't done the trick, and it may not do the trick this time, but if we're not in that kind of situation, then Greenspan is trying to work his magic. And the rest of the world, by the way, is not doing very well at all. Most economies are flat or declining. Chinese economy is still growing strongly, but that's about it. Australia and Canada are doing reasonably well, but not too many other places. The European economies are about flat in GDP terms, and employment is actually still declining. I'll have more commentary on the rest of the world's economic situation next week, but it's not a very pretty picture. And let's listen to this little bit of music from The Moves, their topographic map, and then go right into the Hillary Wainwright interview. Hillary Wainwright is editor of a magazine called Red Pepper, and also the author of a book called Reclaim the State, which will be coming out from Verso in a month or two. And more on both Red Pepper and her book at the end of the interview. But first we'll listen to The Moves and then go right into the Hillary Wainwright interview. Mm-hmm.
you've just been in the U.S. Before we talk about the British political scene, what were your impressions of your visit here?
My main impression was real kind of shock and feeling of being aghast at the level of repression and fear. You know, I talked to people, young woman on the plane, for example, who was against the war, but who felt she just couldn't talk about it at work. And that kind of experience came up again and again. I think that's the biggest contrast, that here, without sort of implying that somehow Britain is a great sort of democracy, there is a very open debate, and there isn't yet, high levels of repression and infringements of civil liberties, which does seem to be really the problem in the United States. But on the other hand, I think the other impression, on the more optimistic side, I got the feeling that the anti-war movement is, it's not going to disappear, you know, that it's led to a kind of confidence and determination to create some alternative democratic force in American politics, which might span, you know, might learn from the Rainbow Coalition, span the Democrats and those outside, but learn that it's got to be sort of bottom up and build on the coalitions created in many cities and towns throughout the country.
Any thoughts on what explains the differences between the two political cultures? You know, we do share some common roots. Why have we diverged?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I think perhaps the fact that the labour movement in Britain, through the defeats it's been through under Thatcher, you know, it has survived in a way in which the United States, I suppose, the defeats happened much earlier. That in a way, one's seeing both the repeat and also the legacy of the McCarthy era, when all that sort of pluralism, that political pluralism that the Labour movement represented, was really destroyed. In Britain, the Labour movement, you know, mainly through the strength of the trade unions, you know, has maintained a degree of pluralism, which in the country, at any rate, we'll come on to Parliament, but I think it's not there in Parliament, but it is there within the country, and it's made it very difficult for the centre, as it were, the state, to exert the kind of control that it would like.
And let's talk a bit about what's happening in Britain. Here, George Bush enjoys very high approval ratings. Even a very large percentage of the American public believes that Iraq used weapons of mass destruction during the war. And in Britain, Tony Blair's government is in crisis over having cooked the evidence, and that's hardly an issue here. First of all, brief us on what the situation of the Blair government is right now.
Yes, I mean, he just come through a sticky patch yesterday where he was under attack from the two cabinet ministers that resigned over the war, Robin Cook, who resigned before the war, and Claire Short, who resigned after, in a way rather pathetically, but still her resignation is significant because she basically says that she was lied to. I mean, she was kept on board by the intelligence statements by Tony Blair. And in Parliament, he got away with it, for reasons I'll explain. But in the country, there's deep mistrust. I mean, recently, 65% or roundabout there said they couldn't trust Tony Blair. And 80% of Labour voters said they would change the way they voted as a result. There is a deep distrust in the country. I think that's the significant effect. I don't think he's facing an immediate political crisis in Parliament. I mean, this is partly because of the tribal nature of British politics and the lack of an electoral system that gives expression to minorities and to a plurality of political parties. So now you have a situation where the Conservatives have joined forces with the Liberal Democrats to demand a public inquiry, an open public inquiry into the accusation that the government sexed up, i.e. sort of hyped up, manipulated the intelligence to exaggerate the weapons of mass destruction issue. But the effect of the Tories supporting this Lib Dem demand is to lead Labour to close ranks. So there were only 11 rebel MPs that supported the proposal for an independent inquiry. So I think Tony Blair has been sort of saved in Parliament by the rather sort of primitive nature of British parliamentary politics. But I think he's going to suffer in the country in the longer term.
And, of course, Labour has a huge majority in the Parliament, right?
Yes, it's got over 100 seats. But, I mean, it came down to 98, the majority. But, you know, it didn't reflect the feeling there is, both in the country and in the, privately in the parliamentary party. I mean, there's one more obstacle he's got to face. I mean, there is going to be an inquiry by the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, but it's going to be held in secret behind closed doors. One wouldn't put much faith in it. On the other hand, it includes MPs who have grown increasingly hostile to the government, and maybe the pressure in the country will lead that select committee to feel it's got to be tough in its questioning. But, you know, the problem is that there's no clear alternative to Tony Blair. I mean, you know, the Conservatives, nobody wants, and they're really hopeless. I mean, yesterday in Parliament, you could see Tony Blair relax when Ian Duncan Smith tried to tackle him. The Lib Dems, you know, have gained a little, but they've not taken a strong enough stance. They were against the war before the war began, and when the war began, they vacillated. So they haven't really been champions of the anti-war movement or sort of critics of the government. And then within the Labour Party itself, there's this endless sort of clash of egos between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, but there's hardly a cigarette paper between them on the issue of the war. I mean, Brown was a pretty loyal supporter on everything, you know, including the intelligence issues. So, you know, that internal battle isn't going to come to the fore.
The major difference between the two of them is over the euro, right?
Over the year and over the issue of hospitals, a sort of proposal to sort of effectively, it'll have the effect of privatising hospitals. But even on privatisation, you know, Gordon Brown isn't sort of in fundamental disagreement with Blair.
And what about within the ranks of the party? Is there how much dissatisfaction with Blair and that whole style of third way politics, which seems dying elsewhere?
Yeah, I think within the party there's deep dissatisfaction, but on the whole it leads to people leaving because the mechanisms of democracy in the party have been completely closed down. So people just feel it's pointless to remain. I mean, some people remain because they feel it's their party, but, you know, what's happened recently is that in local elections you get left candidates getting defeated, as it were, from the left. You know, people are voting to protest against the government, and the voices of the left are completely drowned out by the policies of the government, voices of the government. So, in a way, the Labour Party is becoming a more and more hollow institution. It's hollowness rather than rebellion that's the way in which disaffection is having an impact.
It's sounding a bit like our Democratic Party.
Yes, I mean, I think, exactly, I think it is becoming more and more Americanized. I mean, in some ways, Blair wants this, so he takes any opportunity to expel or threaten with expulsion dissenting figures who cause debate. I mean, like George Galloway, and then more recently, John McDonnell. I mean, they've not actually been expelled, but there's a lot of threats and so on. So I think he'd like to see the left pack up its bags. I mean, that's one reason why some, you know, many on the left sort of are determined to stay, but it's a bit of a stalemate.
What's your understanding of why Blair is such a loyal love slave to American imperial policy? What does Britain get out of it?
I think it goes back again to the pettiness and tribalism of British politics. I think basically it's because Blair's determined that the Tories won't gain the status of being the transatlantic partner of the President of the United States. So he moved in as soon as Bush got elected to maintain the relationship he had with Clinton and prevent the Tories from capturing what Blair, I suppose, assumed was somehow high ground of that special relationship. I don't think the British people gain anything, but our military setup is completely dependent on the United States. I mean, I think in terms of popular opinion, one reason why there was so much opposition to the war is because the majority of British people don't like President Bush and don't trust him. And so this alliance that, that Blair's constructed with Bush, I think, you know, it could well undermine him in the long run electorally.
What's the likelihood of Britain signing on for any kind of future military adventures in Iran or Syria or North Korea, wherever the Bush administration decides to move its action next?
Well, I think it's very difficult for Blair to disentangle himself, to be honest. I think he'll do his best to dissuade Bush from precipitate action. But, you know, as we know, he's got no real clout with Bush. I think Bush will sort of occasionally adopt rhetoric to suit Blair's purposes. But, I think it's going to be difficult for him to follow Bush and the sort of neocon gang wherever they go. I mean, he's certainly not paving the way for any disengagement or any sort of critical relationship. And the problem is there's so little opposition to him here. I mean, one thing I forgot to say, which was that the situation in Scotland, I mean, I think that it's important now to see the UK not just as Westminster, but there's now a Scottish Parliament and a Welsh Parliament. And in the Scottish Parliament, the left, meaning both an independent socialist party and the Green Party, and a sort of group of independent leftists, did extremely well and actually virtually held the balance of power. Now, I don't think Blair's particularly bothered about Scotland, but it's just a sign of an underlying discontent. But at the moment, it doesn't impinge on parliamentary politics. So he, you know, he can get away with what he wants. And also he's out of touch. He's becoming increasingly out of touch. I think that's another thing that could lead him to sign on to further military action. I think perhaps the only constraint will come from his desire to be a leader in Europe and him finding that actually, you know, other European powers are not going to be manipulated and pressured into support for the US in the way that they have been in the past. So I think he's in an uncertain position, really.
How sustainable is this this half-in, half-out of Europe, half, you know, American Trojan horse within Europe, whatever the relation is? How long can Britain remain sort of undecided about whether to accept full membership in the whole European project?
There's no real debate about it, because the Labour Party's been hollowed out, the Tories are pretty hopeless, the Lib Dems are weak. There's no real political debate, no real political argument. So, again, I mean, Blair, I think, for a period, can do what he wants, can delay and prevaricate. I think any further military action by the United States will probably bring it to a head and make it very difficult for Blair to go along with the US and retain any sort of respect or allegiance from Europe, from France and Germany particularly.
What you describe sounds like a pretty fairly grim situation. Is there any hope for breaking out of it?
Not on the immediate horizon. I mean, there are forces in the UK. I mean, I talked about Scotland. Also, the trade unions are increasingly political. I think that's quite significant. You know, we've been through a period under Thatcher where the unions were very much on the defensive and very limited in their political issues they took on. But, for example, in the anti-war movement, the unions played a very central role. You know, they resourced the anti-war movement. They mobilized for it. And also the unions now are led, many of them are led by a new generation of trade union leader that's been very much brought into office by a rank-and-file revolt against the old-style trade union baron that did deals behind closed doors with the government. So I think the trade unions, who are also very open to alliances with community movements, peace, you know, the wider social movement politics, that's grown up around the war and over other issues. So, without being over-romantic, I think that the trade unions are going to be a very important source. I think the other thing is there's a growing internationalism in Britain. I mean, Britain's renowned for its sort of nationalism, and this afflicted the left in the past. But, you know, one sees growing involvement by particularly young people, but across the generation in international demonstrations against the G8 in the World Social Forum that have taken place in Porto Alegre, the development of a European social forum. So I think things are changing beneath the surface of British politics, but it'll take time to break through.
And the immediate question, you think Blair is going to survive this little round of trouble?
I think he will, yeah. I think it's sort of indictment of the British Parliament and how the gap between the British Parliament and the British people, but I think he'll rely on the kind of inertia and complacency of the British Parliament.
And that was Hilary Wainwright, who is the editor of the magazine Red Pepper and also author of a forthcoming Verso book, Reclaim the State, Adventures in Popular Democracy. That should be out late June, early July from Verso. And Red Pepper is a British magazine, but you can visit their website at redpepper, one word, .org.uk. It is a, as it describes itself, as an independent magazine of the green and radical left. And you can get some sample articles and subscribe at that website, redpepper.org.uk. And let's take a little break with this song from The Moves, and then we'll be back with Hamid Dabashi.
Like wildlife for someone else's pet, you want her to pay you special attention. You're scared of her 'cause she's so smart, but there's no resisting, no resisting her. She's very big. Sometimes you think she hates you. You wander over the nice things she
And that was The Moves, a sadly defunct band from Northampton, Massachusetts, and their song Easter Present. And now, my name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And don't forget to visit that website, a vigorously updated, lively place, and full of information about the radio station and also the outside world. So always worth a visit, WBAI.org. And now we're joined in the studio by Hamid Dabashi, who teaches in the Middle Eastern Studies Department at Columbia University, a sociologist of culture, specializing in Iran, the history, culture, politics of Iran, and author most recently of the book Close Up, Iranian Cinema, Past, Present, and Future. Welcome to the studio.
Good to see you.
Well, I think the last time we had you on here, we were talking about a very lively student movement, some really promising democracy agitation in Iran. Now Iran is in the news because it is vying with North Korea for the top of the charts in the axis of evil. So
exactly.
What's happened to the democracy movement in Iran?
Well, it is still very much there, but the mood is much more somber since the Iraqi invasion and since the threat of invasion of Iran by United States. There has been certainly a halt for democratization. And before this invasion started, the president had submitted a proposal to the Congress for expanding presidential authorities and, in fact, limiting the arbitrary power of three undemocratic organs of the Islamic Republic. Finally, Khatami was catching up with democratization movement led by students from 1999 because, in effect, he's not very effective president. But since the Iraq invasion and certainly since the possibility of invasion of Iran has been in the news, in fact, we have had a reversal of the situation, and the progressive movements are very much in the defensive. And the religious right are, in fact, on the attack.
Do you have any sense of why the Bush administration is not allying itself with the democratic movement? Couldn't it co-opt it or exploit it for its own purposes? Or is it too leftist for its own
comfort? Not at all. Not at all. They are all for globalization. They are all for open market. They are for diversifying Iranian economy. Khatami's economic situation is 85% oil-based. And that is not a very healthy situation. He wants to diversify his economics. But in terms of the principles of his economic plans and globalizing modernization, this is straight out of World Bank and IMF and so forth. There is no reason whatsoever why Iran, in the long run, the progressive elements. But since here in this country we don't have any long-term plan, and the situation currently after the invasion of Iraq is to have the immediate control over the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. This is, in my judgment, a proxy war between European Union and United States in terms of control of the global resources. They don't want to ally themselves. Or they cannot, or they don't have the political imagination. I don't know what the specifics are.
But yeah, I was gonna say, do you think they're just ignorant of what Iran is like?
Two things: a combination of ignorance and lack of sort of political planning in the long run. There is nothing in Khatami's economic plan that is contrary to sort of globalizing modernity that the United States currently is after. Nothing. They will happily abandon any sympathy they may have for the Palestinians. They are more anti-Taliban than the United States is anti-Taliban. They have nothing in terms of their specific plans and their national interest that is against Bush's administration's plan for the region, except they are very much devoted to a notion of Islamic democracy. And Islamic democracy is rather messy, as all democracies are messy, and they cannot immediately deliver. They have a legitimate parliament, contrary to our own Senate and, since the war.
Well, let's talk about some of the preposterous claims the Bush administration has been making. First of all, that Iran is somehow allied with al-Qaeda.
That is the most ridiculous thing that you ever heard. First of all, we have to make a division between the legitimate government of President Khatami that has absolutely nothing to do with al-Qaeda. And in fact, they have been fighting both with Taliban and with al-Qaeda long before September 11 started. And in 1997, 98, they practically, Iran and Taliban went to war. There was a very tense situation.
Is this over religion, or is there some material or political aspect?
No, it was over control of Afghanistan. That is, as you remember, Doc, a Taliban was created by Pakistani intelligence on behest of the American fighting for the Soviet Union. And the Persian Gulf Arab states, who were threatened by Khomeini's regime, very much welcomed Taliban, because Taliban upped the ante in terms of religious fundamentalism. And they supported it. So during the 5 years of Taliban, in fact, Afghanistan became a site of a proxy war between Shi'i Iranians and Sunni Arab fundamentalism. That was the principal contention between Iran and Pakistan over control of Afghanistan, with Taliban as the intermediary.
And also now we hear Rumsfeld and folks like that warning Iran not to get involved in post-war Iraq. What's happening?
Yeah,
with that?
That we have to read it more carefully. 65% population of Iraq, as you know, are the Shi'is. And if you look at the composition of the Shi'i, politically active Shi'i organization in southern Iraq, many of them want the most progressive, not the most progressive, the most active under the leadership of Ayatollah Hakim. In fact, the organization that he runs is called Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They want to have an Islamic government. Whether or not on the model of Iran is a different issue. So Iran has both a strategic and economic interest in southern Iraq. But whether or not they can manipulate things is a different issue. Now, in order to balance the power of Iranians in the southern Iraq, the United States has sustained the power of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, an anti-Islamic republic force in northern Iraq, which used to be a revolutionary, in fact, organization, Mujahideen organization, but they became a mercenary army after the success of Islamic Revolution. They have kept them intact. Now, it is important to notice that officially they are on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations, but the U.S. has kept them intact in northern Iraq in order to let them loose into Iranian territory if Iranians begin to create trouble for them in the south. Now, the situation is that the threatening, Rumsfeld's threatening of the Iranians not to intervene in Iraqi affairs is in fact is a signal to 65% of the Iraqi populations themselves, the Shi'i population, not to demand a religious fundamentalist theocracy, which of course is a nobody wants Saddam Hussein to succeed by a theocracy, but that remains to be seen in terms of the post-Saddam composition of power inside Iraq. It is not to be determined either by Iranians or by Rumsfeld.
I'm speaking with Hamid Dabashi, who teaches Middle Eastern studies and specializes in Iran at Columbia University. Now, this Sunni-Shia split, again, is this all a religious theological split, or is there ethnic, political, material, sociological aspects to it?
It begins, Dog, as a religious sectarianism early in Islamic history, about 1,400 years ago. And then it gradually assumes the color of its historical developments. Throughout medieval period, it has been one of the most revolutionary organizations and mobilizing force throughout Islamic history. But since 16th century, when it became the official religion of Iran, it has been, in fact, a regressive and repressive regime. There is something peculiar about Shiism as a religion, that it emerged as a religion of protest, and it only thrives as a religion of protest. If you look at it, for example, in southern Lebanon, when the Shi'is are predominant in southern Lebanon, the Shi'i Hezbollah were the only organization that, in fact, resisted the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon with their political ideology deeply rooted in Shi'ism. But as soon as Shi'ism came into power under Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, it loses its legitimacy. So it is principally a religious and doctrinal and theological division, but it assumes all sort of ethnic and nationalistic elements as well.
And let's talk a bit about the governmental structure of Iran itself. There are big splits, right? There's the branches of the government are split against each other. Could you just give us the rundown on who's who?
Well, the two legitimate organizations of the components of the government is the presidency and the legislative. The legislative and the office of presidency within the confinements of the Islamic Republic constitution are as legitimate and democratic as the Islamic Republic can allow it, the Constitution. Now, the Constitution of Islamic Republic is not the ideal organization. There are at least three non-democratic institutions within it, beginning with the Office of the Supreme Ruler. However, within that confinement, since 1997, successive presidential elections and parliamentary elections have solidly established the Office of Presidency and the Parliament as democratic institutions. What remains entirely undemocratic is the judiciary system. So a combination of the judiciary system, the office of the supreme leader, and non-democratic component of the Islamic Republic constitute the religious right, and they are heavily controlling the army, the police, the secret police, as well as 85% of non-oil-related economy. That's the source of their income. And then the Office of the Presidency and the Parliament are the legitimate organizations trying to democratize within the confinement of an Islamic republic, which I think...
And they control the oil.
They control the oil, which is a mixed blessing, because 85% of the Iranian economy is oil-based, and that's catastrophic, because oil-based economy, as you know, is capital-intensive, it's not labor-intensive. As a result, they cannot generate a healthy economy. The religious right can generate labor unrest any time that they want and jeopardize Khatami's government via labor unrest. And unless Khatami diversifies his economic plan in a way, uses the oil revenue to diversify and generate jobs, as a result, it has a healthy economic program, it will always be at the mercy of religious right and the control of the non-oil-related economy.
And what do they do with the oil revenues?
They provide the bread and butter of daily life. Most of the population is government employees. But since 1998, 1998-1999, we had a sudden rise in the oil revenue. Khatami began to generate jobs. In 1997, about 3 million high school graduates participated in the national entrance examination for university. The capacity of Iranian university system is about 240,000 in 1997, which is less than 10%. So more than 90% of high school graduates just poured into the streets, jobless, hopeless, and without any sense of their future. And he tried to generate jobs and trainings and so forth for them. But in fact, the religious right is far better in a position to attract and give them jobs.
And a lot of oil-centered economies generate a rather parasitical ruling class.
Very much so.
Does that happen in Iran?
Very much so. But of course, since the revolution, you have had a more or less socialist economy that has tried to cater to the needs of the population at large. It's about 70 million population, 60% of it is under the age of 25. But it is not as corrupt as it used to be under the Shah's regime, that only a very small minority was the beneficiary of the oil revenue. And I remember, for example, 1973, the Arab oil embargo, in which Shah did not participate. Suddenly the oil revenue of Iran skyrocketed to $20 billion a year, which was a bonanza for Shah's family, an obscene manifestations of wealth without any sort of social or economic program that would be beneficiary to the rest of the society.
And you mentioned that 60% of the population is under 25.
Exactly.
That means that majority of the population essentially knows nothing other than this theocracy.
Well, yes and no. So far as the official sources of information and reflections are concerned, yes.
I'm not talking about knowledge of the world, but this is the only kind of government they've had an experience.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But now, of course, oppositional forces such as the Mujahideen, such as even the Shah's son, who is now very active from Washington, D.C., they are known. But the thing to know is that the student movement that in 1999 came to the fore, it is the most peculiar aspect of it is that it is not an ideological movement. It is not socialist or nationalist or Islamist. It is after the nitty-gritty of the most basics of their daily necessities. That is, they need jobs, they need opportunities, they need to be able to travel freely, socialize freely, etc. So it is no longer, this is a unique phenomenon since the beginning of the 19th century, that always social revolutions and social mobilizations in Iran have had either a nationalist or a socialist or an Islamist ideological banner under which they have been mobilized. But since the Islamic Revolution, in fact, the young generation, and you can see it in their cinema, in their art, in their poetry, in their literature, is entirely without any high ideals or categorical commitment to any ideology one sort or another.
And how deeply felt is the religion throughout the society?
Very, very thin. Very, very thin. In fact, the irony of it is that under an Islamic republic, under a theocracy, the state of religious, some polls have been done inside by Iranian pollsters who are now actually in trouble because of the polls that they did. They, in terms of even ritual and habitual commitment to religious behavior, you have had a massive decline of religious sentiment to the point that even the previous generations, the parents, grandparents, are somehow ashamed of the religious convictions and religious behavior.
I guess you need nothing like a theocracy to turn people off.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely.
What about the atomic weapons program? That's, of course, the thing that has the United States so exercised. There's a lot of talk about the Russians helping Iran with the program. Why do you think they want the bomb, and what's going on with the Russian alliance?
Okay, I think if you put your position, Doug, in position of Iranians, there are two reasons for them to be attracted in nuclear energy, both for economic reasons and for defensive purposes. Economically, Khatami must diversify the sources of his energy. He cannot be entirely oil-based. He wants to have nuclear energy for legitimate economic and peaceful purposes. But if you look at it politically, Iran is the only major force in the region that is non-nuclear. It is surrounded by Israel and Pakistan. They both have nuclear power. Even Turkish authorities talk to Iranians, they talk down to them because they're affiliated with NATO. Russia obviously has nuclear capabilities. So Iran is located between all of these countries. All of them have nuclear capability, and Iran is the only one that doesn't have nuclear capability. Do we have, the progressive elements, the peaceful elements and reformist elements within the government have been talking about the regional security plan. For example, Ambassador Javad Zarif, the Iranian ambassador to UN, recently wrote an op-ed for New York Times in which he proposed this idea of a regional security that will then allow Iran not to go nuclear. But in the absence of a regional security and surrounded by nuclear powers, you know, it is very logical for them to go for nuclear.
And what do you think the reaction would be if the United States were to emulate Israel's bombing of Iraq's reactor 20 years ago and do the same thing?
Nothing. They can't. I mean, Iran obviously militarily is not in a position to do anything. And the only scenario that I can think of that cannot be catastrophic, as it has been catastrophic in Iraq, is in fact a surgical attack on Natanz or whatever else that there are nuclear capabilities, the way that Israel did with Iraq in the 80s. And sort of a hit-and-run situation and get it over with. There will be ranting and raving in Iran, but nothing will happen. But if indeed they have the capacity, right now with the catastrophe of the Iraqi situation that we were duped to believe that Saddam Hussein had, nuclear or biological capabilities, nothing has surfaced yet. We don't even know that, in fact, they do have a capability that needs to be knocked down at this moment, and we don't have any reliable source. UN has lost its credibility. The International Atomic Energy has lost its credibility after the Iraqi situation, and certainly U.S. and United Kingdom are not in a position to tell anybody what Iran is or is not capable of.
But if the Bush administration were crazy enough to try to invade Iran, they're having a hard enough time with Iraq, which is a much smaller country. What would the effects be?
My own estimate is that it would be catastrophic. It will play straight in the hand of the religious right. They will want nothing more than it would be again 1980, Iran-Iraq war that in fact generated, created, and sustained an Islamic Republic. Soon after the hostage crisis of 1979-1980 ended, under which smoking screen, you remember, they institutionalized an Islamic Republic and prevented any debate for preventing a theocracy to happen. Then the war between Iran and Iraq started between 1980 and 1988, and for 8 years, again under the smoke screen of war, which was a devastating and horrible war between Iran and Iraq, the institutions of Islamic Republic were solidified, all oppositions eradicated, and we ended up with what we ended up. Now, if there is another attack, the immediate consequence for Iran is the solidification of the religious right, again going back to 1980 of Khomeini. Khomeini already looks like Khomeini, is assuming the posture of Khomeini and is speaking the way Khomeini spoke. Not only for U.S., because Iran is much larger country, both in terms of geography and in terms of population, and would be a quagmire, worse than Iraq for American troops to get involved with. But in terms of the consequences, would be even worse for theocratic and religious fundamentalism for years to come. I mean, we haven't seen even the end of what has happened in Iraq. Things that happened in Saudi Arabia and Morocco immediately after the Iraqi invasion are, in my judgment, just the tip of the iceberg.
I know you've alluded several times to the effects of the war in Iraq, but talk a little bit more about it. How did that play in Iran, and what are the repercussions been?
Well, initially, it could go both ways, because the progressive sort of elements, I call them progressive, I mean reform-minded, I agree with everything that they do. The reformists, they were beginning to sort of put the positive spin on it and saying that if a country has democratic institutions and is run democratically. Nobody can invade it. So they were trying to sort of use the occasion for their own benefits. But, of course, the religious right and says, okay, here is the United States. You want us to establish a relationship with the United States? Here is the United States. The only thing that they care about is world domination, control of oil, control of the Persian Gulf. So it was a healthy debate and conversation and dialogue between the religious right and the progressive reformist. But the more the possibility of the war began to loom large, the more, obviously, nationalist elements now begin to unite both of them together, and they both assume defensive postures to the detriment of the cause of democracy, in my judgment, in Iran.
Now, if the Bush administration were to be suddenly overtaken by sanity and would stop this relentless saber-rattling, what would you think would the evolution be in Iran? Would the theocrats fall?
I think... Dog, what had happened in Islamic revolution, there has always been in Islamic societies the nightmare of an Islamic theocracy. The Islamic revolution in Iran and Taliban in Afghanistan was the interpretation of this nightmare. What would happen if there were to be an Islamic takeover? And you remember that almost at the same time as the Islamic revolution in Iran, Algerians were about to go to vote, and they would have voted an Islamic government, and then they prevented the voting and, in fact, prevented an Islamic republic to take over in Algeria. But in Iran, an Islamic republic did come to power, and Iranians experienced a decade under Khomeini, which was a brutal a tyranny. But from the ashes of that experience, very fragile steps towards democracy and democratization, which is loyal and legitimate and domestic to an Islamic political culture, has started taking shape. And in my judgment, democracy is messy and has to be rooted in the political culture of the region. It doesn't have to follow any model. And by the way, what model? Our own democratic institutions right here in the United States since the last election have been systematically corroded. If you put together the Homeland Security Act of 2001 and the Patriot Act of 2002 and the specter of the Patriot Act 2 together, you and I have more civil liberties under an Islamic Republic in Iran than we do here.
Well, that's a grim note to end on. Thanks for joining us, Hamid Damashi, who is a professor in the Middle Eastern Studies Department at Columbia University and author of most recently the book on Iranian cinema, Close Up, Iranian Cinema, Past, Present, and Future. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and I'll be back next week. But let's go out with this 1980 classic from Heaven 17. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist groove thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass and look that funky chain dance. Brothers, sisters, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
History will repeat itself. Crisis point, we're near the hour. Counterforce will do no good. Hard you ask, I feel your power. Hitler proves that funky stuff. It's not for you and me, girl.
No, 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 no.
Europe's in happy land. They've had their fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
Democrats are out of power. Across that blue wide ocean, Reagan's president-elect, fascist god in motion. J.
generals tell them what to do. Stop your good time dancing. Train their guns on me and you. Fascist gang advancing. Sisters, brothers, lend a hand. Increase our population. Grab everything by the throat and throw it in the ocean. You're real tonight, you move my soul. Let's cruise on the dance floor. Come out your house and dance your dance. Shake that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
FM WBAI New York.